Some of you know I wasn't here last Sunday, nor the Sunday before, because the week in between those two, I was teaching in California. First in Santa Cruz for 4 days, there were workshops for our division of chaplains. And so I was doing workshops for military chaplains and prison chaplains and hospital chaplains and pastoral counselors. There were about 50 of them there. And interestingly enough, about a third of those were immigrants to this country, serving in different places, doing God's work, caring for God's people. Well, it was a pretty dramatic beginning to the week with all the storms that have been coming in off the ocean there. But then, by the end of the week, Margaret and I had 2 days that we got to spend in San Francisco. This was special in part because we had gone on our honeymoon to San Francisco 31 years ago. But also, it was special because a good friend of mine, whom I met in the fall of 1969 in a building right across the street here that no longer stands. They're tearing down every evidence that I ever attended Vanderbilt University. Not sure why they feel the need to do that, but. And we have been friends ever since. He retired from serving churches just this past year. So on two really, really beautiful days, Gary Barbary showed Margaret and me around San Francisco. Well, Gary and I, in our youth, learned to carry on foolishness with each other, and it's one of those friendships that just picks right back up where you left off. So when we get together, we carry on foolishness again. And we had all kinds of silly sayings and nonsensical sayings, but one of them, to describe something that we would want to show someone, we would say, well, you know, it's the same, only different. And that's true of most things, isn't it? It's what we call metaphorical thinking. We look at two things when we use a metaphor that are on the surface different, and we find some similarity in them, some way of looking at the one that reminds us of the other. At the very beginning of the first creation story, the storyteller describes a bowl above the earth, and above the bowl is an ocean with waves. That's the sky and the clouds. Now, we know that it's not an ocean with waves up there, but we know what an ocean with waves looks like. That reminds us of it, and so metaphorically, we get the idea. It's the same, only different, right? Well, often we look at the differences, and the differences frighten us when we can't see the sameness that two people or two objects even share. Right out of college, I taught on the Upper Cumberland in Putnam County. I was a substitute teacher for $12 a day. That's how I made my fortune. In a junior high school, and if we had used up all of the planning the teacher had done for that day, or if there wasn't planning in the book for me to follow, I would often do various word games and exercises with the students. Among them was a thing called the alphabet poem. And it had a very simple structure. The first word of the poem began with A, the second word began with B, the third with C, and so on through the alphabet. Well, some of those were pretty easy, but you get down toward the end of the alphabet, it gets hard. And when we wound up at X, the first poem was usually X-ray, right? That was the first word in the poem. But if we had to do it again, it was much harder. Because a lot of X words don't sound like they're X words, like xylophone. After the third time, they would go scurrying for their dictionaries, and these junior high kids in Putnam County discovered a word they had never seen or heard before: xenophobia, the fear of the other, the fear of the foreigner, the fear of the one who is different. They were probably the only junior high kids on the Upper Cumberland who could use xenophobia correctly. When we fail to think in metaphorical terms, when we fail to see what is similar about us and only concentrate on the differences, sometimes we wind up fearing the other. A lot of research has been done on implicit bias. We all have an implicit bias, and we all are able to make distinctions. If I couldn't make a distinction with the whole choir in choir robes, I couldn't tell that they were different people. I mean, faces are fairly similarly structured, but I know each and every face is different, even though there are similarities. So it's important for us to be able to make those distinctions. The problem arises in that we tend to be much more comfortable with those people who look like we do, who speak the same language we do, who come from the same background we do. And those people who don't, we tend to fear. Xenophobia. This whole story, this whole Elijah story, is about how differences play roles in our lives. Now, the part you didn't hear before Elijah comes on the scene, and this is the very first time we meet Elijah in the Bible. But before that, there is a king whose name is Ahab. And Ahab marries a queen named Jezebel. Now, we have associated Jezebel with all kinds of activities, but the thing that characterizes her in this story is that she is a foreigner. She is not a worshiper of the God of the Hebrews. She is a worshiper of Baal. And she talks Ahab into building an altar to Baal in the country that God had given the Hebrews. Well, this really, really sets Elijah's teeth on edge. So he declares that there will be no rain, there won't even be dew until the altar comes down, until the people come back to the Lord, the God of the Hebrews. And so he leaves. Now, it may be he's leaving because he fears Jezebel and her wrath, or Ahab and his wrath. In any case, he goes out to the Wadi Kareth, that holler with the creek running down the middle of it. He sits by the water, pouting, you might say, and this raven brings him food. Now, he knows a raven is an unclean bird. It's other. It might as well be a foreigner. But the raven brings him food, and he eats the food. And his understanding is that God has used this unclean bird to feed him. Now, that's a pretty big leap for Elijah. He can't imagine that God would use an unclean bird to help feed him because he has just called off all the rain because of unclean worship in God's territory. Well, after a while, there is an unintended consequence that results from not having any rain, and that is that the creek running down the middle of Wadi Kareth dries up, and Elijah has deprived himself of water. I don't think he intended that. So he goes on to a town called Zarephath, and the first person he sees there, he asks for help. She is a widow. Now, believe me, a widow is the last person you want to ask for help. Because in the social structure, widows and orphans are at the very bottom. Kings are judged not by how they treat the rich and the powerful, but how they treat widows and orphans, because they're the least of these. So if you're going somewhere hoping to receive something, you would not think first to go to a widow. But that's what he does. And he asks for bread, and she describes their predicament. She says, I would, this foreign Gentile widow says, I would, but we only have a little flour and we only have a little oil, enough to make some small loaves of bread. And my son and I have decided that what we're going to do is that we're going to bake the bread, we're going to eat it, and after everything is gone, we're going to wait to die. That is how dire her straits are. But Elijah begs and tells her that if she will make a small cake for him as well, that when she goes back to that jar that holds the flour, she will find more flour. And when she goes back to that jug that holds the oil, she will find more oil. Now, he doesn't say it'll be full, mind you, because that's not the way God works. Remember the Exodus? You get enough manna for one day, and then you have to go out the next day and collect it for that day. And that's true of every day except the day prior to the Sabbath, when you can actually collect for 2 days. He doesn't say it will be filled. He says if you use it all up and you go back, you'll find a little bit more in the bottom. And you use that up and go back, you'll find a little bit more in the bottom. And so on, day by day by day. And sure enough, she does that for him. He receives this gift from this foreign woman, this Gentile woman. Now remember, he has just called down this drought because of a foreign woman, a Gentile woman named Jezebel. And now he's asking for help from a foreign woman who is nameless, because after all, she's just a widow. Every day she goes back and there's just enough to make bread for that day. Until finally, following what you heard read, her son, her young son, dies. And she comes to the prophet, she comes to Elijah and says, "Look, I showed you kindness. I gave you the last bit of bread that we had, and now you let my son die? How could you do this?" And so Elijah goes to God and says, "God, raise this child up." And he stretches himself out over the child and prays to God to bring life back into that child, because this woman has shown him a kindness. And now this happens? Now, this part is not in the Bible, but there's an old story that the rabbis told. It's called the Midrash. And the rabbis say that as Elijah was begging God to return life to this child, to the widow's son, God said, "Okay, I tell you what. You let it rain again, I'll bring life back to the child." God is more compassionate than Elijah, which you find often in these stories. God is more compassionate than God's representative. And so the old rabbis say, the child is given life again, and the rain ultimately comes again. In any case, the child walks and moves and is given life again. Now, isn't it interesting that in the story, Jezebel, this foreign woman, is the cause of the problem, the reason that Elijah has to leave? And yet when it comes time to feed him, it is an unclean bird, a bird he's not supposed to receive anything from or to even touch, that feeds him. When it comes time that the water runs out in the creek and he has to go to Zarephath, it is a Gentile, a foreign widow, who provides for him day after day after day. Jesus notices this. When he preaches his very first sermon, he goes back to his home synagogue in Nazareth, and he reads from the Haftarah reading for that day, Isaiah, the prophet. And at that point, everybody is sitting out there, and they are loving him. After all, he's back home. They taught him in Sunday school, right? They remember him when he was a kid, right? They're saying, "Hey, isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't this the builder's son?" And then he starts preaching. Or maybe then he starts meddling. Because he says, "You know, there were plenty of widows in Israel, but Elijah went to a Gentile widow, a foreign widow, and was helped by the foreigner." And the people start to grumble. They don't want to hear about being helped by these foreigners. After all, they don't like these foreigners. These foreigners are unclean somehow. And then Jesus makes it worse with his second example. He says, there were plenty of lepers in Israel, but Elisha healed the Syrian general Naaman. Not only was he a foreigner, not only was he a Gentile, he was an enemy general who had conquered the armies of Israel at one point. So they did to Jesus what you all feel like doing to me occasionally after the sermon. They took him out to the brow of the hill and tried to push him off, because they did not like hearing about those who were different. Why is it that when Timothy McVeigh blows up a building in Oklahoma City, we don't all get really scared every time we see a young white man? He looks like us, right? If we share that skin color. Now, some of you sitting here may be afraid when you see a young white man coming your way. You might even be afraid when you see an old white man coming your way. But for those of us who are white, just let somebody from another country do anything out of the way. Let somebody whose skin color is different from ours do anything out of the way, and we're afraid of a whole race. We're afraid of a whole tribe. We're afraid of a whole nationality. What we miss is the similarity. We are the same, only different, and those differences are the gifts we have to give to each other. Our sameness is found in that same creation story that I spoke about earlier. Because toward the end of that story, it says that God stamped God's image on each and every human being. Now, sometimes we distort it, sometimes we misuse it, sometimes we neglect it, sometimes we ignore it. But God has stamped the image of God on each and every human being. That is our sameness. We are each bearers of God's image. And if we can ever look beyond those differences, if we can ever think metaphorically, to look beyond those differences and see what we share as human beings, then all of a sudden we see that we are kin. This is the widow from whom we receive help. This is the raven from whom we receive help. This is the one we've told is foreign, is somehow unclean. This is the one who bears the image of God, even so. The one that we don't need to be afraid of, because God is using that person to bring gifts to us. I think back to that group in California that I was teaching. God was using a third of that group who had come from all over the world to bring gifts to us, to those in our prisons, to those in our hospitals, to those in our military, to those who need counsel. Like the widow, they were taking of what they had and feeding us, giving to us. So how do we deal with differences? Well, we have a choice. We can be afraid. We can live in fear and terror all the time of anyone who happens to be the least bit different. Or we can look for that image of God in each person we meet. But that means we have to actually meet and listen to them. We can't just stereotype them as those people, the other. We have to see them as children of God, individually. Following the example of God in the story of Elijah, following the example of Jesus preaching in Nazareth, following the example of the church, which reaches around the world, knowing no national boundaries, with God's love for all. Thanks be to God.